Henry Jenkins is the founder and director of the Comparative Media Studies program at MIT. He's also the author of a book called Convergence Culture, Where Old and New Media Collide. So what does Jenkins mean by the term convergence culture?
Well, often when people in the media industry talk about convergence, they're talking about technological convergence, which is essentially, they reduce it to which black box will all the media in our lives flow through. But I want to argue that we already live in a convergence culture, by which I mean that every major story, every image, every sound, every brand, every relationship in our lives flow through the maximum number of media channels. And that flow is being shaped top-down by decisions made in corporate boardrooms and bottom-up by decisions made in teenagers' bedrooms. So how we consume media today is radically changed by simply the fact that media companies are wanting to exploit every division of their now conglomerate structure, and consumers are coming to expect the media they want, where they want it, when they want it, and the form they want it, and they'll take it there illegally if they can't get it there legally. So that's the dynamic I'm trying to describe, and how that flow of media across media channels shapes the way we relate to the television we watch, the books we read, the movies we watch, and so forth.
What do you think is having the most impact? Is it the attempt by the many different kinds of media to converge these different streams, or is it the consumer who is probably dictating the ways in which they're able to succeed by convergence?
Well, it's a kind of tug-of-war right now. I mean, they're both moving in the same direction on one level, that there's a moving toward a world where stories will flow fairly freely across platforms, and they're moving toward a world where most of us will be participants in some way in shaping the flow of media in our lives. Everyone agrees we're going to be more participatory, but there's not generally agreed upon terms of participation. And so there's a push and pull going on. You read in the paper one day and there's an announcement of some new decision by Yahoo or Google or MTV or some other media company that's going to affect this. And you read the following day, there's some bottom-up grassroots creative appropriation going on that's shocking the media companies and forcing them again to crack down on YouTube or to try to sort out a new policy for dealing with user-generated content. So it's the push and pull between those two forces, I think, that's really shaping the media environment right now.
And that's, I guess, what I was thinking is that in that way, it's very exciting because it sort of offers limitless possibilities.
I think it's a very exciting time. Some people have used the word churn, and churn means chaos that generates something new. It's the kind of disruptiveness of these technologies and the cultural practices around them that's generating new forms of expression, both commercial and grassroots. We're seeing new kinds of stories, what I call transmedia stories, that are told, you know, systematically integrated across a variety of different media platforms. And we're seeing new forms of fan culture, new kinds of subcultural appropriation, blogging, podcasting, video podcasting, all springing up at the same time. It's a period of a lot of cross-fertilization between communities that might historically have been held separate from each other.
One of the things that I found fascinating is this whole idea of what you call transmedia storytelling. And I guess one of the most successful attempts at it was in the movie trilogy, The Matrix. Is that a good example to talk about it?
Yeah, I think The Matrix is interesting. You call it a trilogy, and it's certainly true that there were three feature films. But part of the point is that there were also some, you know, half a dozen or so animated shorts made by top animators from Japan, Korea, and across Asia, that there were several bound graphic novels worth of comic stories done by some of the top comic book artists in the industry. There have been now three Matrix games, all of which were not just sort of ancillary products, licensed spinoffs, but part of the general plan of the project, that the Wachowski brothers, who created The Matrix, sat down and really said, we want to create a world that's richer than can be explored in a single medium. We want to use each of these medium well. We want to bring in top collaborators from around the world to enhance that experience. The challenge with The Matrix, I think, is that very few people consumed all of it. And it's because the information was scattered, so the key plot points might be unveiled in the game that you needed to understand the movies, that an awful lot of people left the theater scratching their head or frustrated that the pieces didn't seem to add up. We don't know how to watch a transmedia story yet, but our kids do. I mean, the kids who are watching Pokemon are really consuming a story that, you know, includes 145 races or species or whatever we want to call them. And the information about them is scattered across multiple media platforms. And they become very adept at taking information from one place and attaching it to another. It allows every kid in America to have some expertise about Pokemon or Yu-Gi-Oh! Or one of those other series that no other kid around the playground knows. And that's what people have called hypersociality. That is, they enable people to talk to each other and pool knowledge. It's a form of expression designed for a network society, or what my book is calling a collective intelligence or knowledge community.
Of course, it seems to me that there are a couple of problems with it. And again, my use of the word trilogy was almost unfortunate from my point of view, because I'm one of those people who didn't consume all of the different elements of it. And while I enjoyed the movie The Matrix, by the time I got to the second one, I was already missing so much information that I never watched the third one.
And I think that's the experience of an awful lot of people if you look at the box office returns. The media is struggling to how to deal with complexity. There is a segment of the media audience that really wants to, when it finds something it likes, it wants to drill down really deep. It wants to have a high degree of complexity. But then there are casual viewers for whom the complexity leaves them in the dust. I go back to Twin Peaks, which I was watching back when I was in Madison years ago as a grad student. When you watched Twin Peaks, read the newspapers about Twin Peaks, they were saying this is a series that was so complex no one could follow it. You went online to an online community and they were saying the series is getting simpler and simpler and dumber and we're losing interest.
Yeah.
What people can process as a community online is so much more complex than what an individual viewer can process that we really are at a transitional point where more and more television and films are being designed to be watched through the lens of online communities, and yet most of us don't have the time to invest in that. But you jump ahead from Twin Peaks to Lost, and Lost is one of the highest rated shows in American television. It probably has 18 different subplots going at any given point in time. It has maps that flash on the screen for a split second, and you only can really read if you freeze frame and blow it up and put it on the internet. It's a television designed to be watched by people who are part of online communities. And you would think that's avant-garde, but it's popular enough that hunger for complexity draws a lot of people in who really do engage with Lost at a pretty deep level.
But that's the other end of the problem. And they've got people like me who really only understood the first issue of The Matrix and who never got into Lost at all. And then you have the others who, it seems to me, with all of the information available, could become obsessed with this and spend almost all of their lives immersing themselves in these stories.
It's what some people have called the encyclopedic tendency of contemporary popular culture that really does become this vast reference work that you really could dig deep and deep in. The thing is, it becomes then a resource that people use to talk about other questions. So the discussions around The Matrix rapidly become a discussion about religion because of all the religious analogies that are run through that text. It becomes a discussion about mythology because of the use of Morpheus and, you know, Trinity and so forth. It becomes a discussion of literature because of the Alice in Wonderland references, or of outsourcing in India because of the appearance of the South Asian family in the third Matrix film. What you see is that the text is rich enough and immersive enough that in different groups for different conversations can take pieces of it and begin to use it as a resource. And so it's not just, it becomes a lens through which a lot of other issues get explored. So, you know, yes, you can become obsessed in any given text, but the text also becomes an opening for a wider range of conversations, many of which I think people need to be having.
Henry Jenkins is the author of Convergence Culture, Where Old and New Media Collide.